Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. I'm going to guess that you've probably experienced heartbreak. I know I've had my heart broken, and maybe you're in the thick of it right now. If so, take heart, because this week's essay, written by renowned novelist Lily King, offers a silver lining to heartbreak. Zoe Lister-Jones, writer, director, and star of the new film Band-Aid, reads Lily King's essay, "An Empty Heart is One That Can Be Filled."
I was 31 before I got my heart broken. It was spring. I had quit my job and driven across country to an artist's colony in New England, the kind of place that provides you with a cabin in the woods that is not within sight of any of the other cabins. My residency was for 8 weeks. I hoped to finish my first novel there. The poet arrived a week after I did. He was too skinny, but his eyes were very blue. I think his first words to me were something about how his throat felt tight. I was feeling the same thing, I told him. Maybe, he said, it was a reaction to all the MSG they put in the food. A rumor was circulating that the MSG came in by the case to the back door of the kitchen. This, I think, tells you all you need to know about how writers will, despite being given room and board and lunch dropped off in a basket on the porch, manufacture anxiety. My first joke with the poet was about Lolita. We were sitting at dinner, and another writer was going on and on about the novel. The poet and I both said that the disturbing pedophilia canceled out the luscious prose, and we could not worship it the way we would like. Actually, we may have just caught eyes, not having to explain. Love means never having to explain the misogynistic pedophilia of Lolita. And the other writer fought back, so the poet held up his napkin as a screen between the Lolita fans and us. Everyone laughed. I swooned. A few nights later, we watched short films made by other residents. There were no seats left, so we stood in the back. He was just behind me, breathing into my hair, our bodies seeming to speak to each other in the dark. When it was over, with hardly a word, we got into my car and drove out of town. We ended up in a small village that had been transported back to 1969 by a film crew with thick wooden signs for the soda shop and beauty parlor and a huge advertisement for old-fashioned men's shoes painted onto a brick building. On the village green was a gazebo. We weren't sure if it was real or for the movie. We climbed its steps and played with cards I'd found in my glove compartment. On the way home, he pressed his lips to my neck. The memory of it made my stomach flip all night long. The spring unfurled like the fat ferns along the road to my cabin. May turned to June. I had grown up in New England, and so had the poet. The humid heat at noon, the cold rains on the roof, his accent, his humor, and his hands on my skin all felt like a home I had nearly forgotten. He was writing poems about bees, sex poems with pollen and stamens and pistils, bees sexing their flowers, sexing their queen, jelly and nectar and death in midair. He'd read them to me in his truck in the parking lot of the lake where we swam. Later, he wrote a poem about that too, how the water turned our arms to amber. We fooled around in his cabin, careful to time it right so the guy delivering lunch to the doorstep wouldn't catch us. I came away giddy, barely able to walk in a straight line. I fell for him so fast, and as if through space, no planet in sight. He had said, or at least I thought he had said, that he and his girlfriend in New York had broken up. But later he said they were taking a break, which was not at all the same thing, and not at all like my recent breakup with a man in California, which had been clean and permanent. Their break, this was pre-cell phone, involved hours in one of the wooden phone cabinets that lined the walls of the living room of the main house. He began saying that our strong physical connection was too intense, maybe even unnatural. He said, as if trying to translate his concern into fiction writer language I would understand, that our connection might be like an unreliable narrator. "Stay away from him," my mother said to me when we spoke on the phone. "You're there to write, so write." I had been revising the same short chapter for weeks. The stress I felt at the colony had begun to transform the place for me from writer's retreat to fitness camp. To keep all the anxiety at bay, I had embraced a brutal workout regimen, running a 12-mile loop, swimming across the lake, and playing tennis in the late afternoon. This athletic schedule didn't leave me much time to write. The poet left a week before I did. We said goodbye in the parking lot. He got into his truck, and as I leaned in the window, he touched his chest and said, "You are deep in here." I tried to believe this was the way a poet says, "I love you." But I knew it was more like the way someone who is not in love dodges those words at the moment they are expected. After that, I wanted to leave too. Finally, I did. My sister in Massachusetts took me in. She lived in a carriage house with her boyfriend, who had a friend who got me a job waiting tables at a fancy restaurant in Cambridge. In August, the poet came to visit, but he stayed with friends in Boston. We drove out to Walden Pond 3 days in a row. We talked and swam and pretended our arms were still amber, but they were not. On the last of those days, he dropped me off at the Sunoco station on Memorial Drive, where I had left my bike that morning. It was over. There were chrysanthemums planted along one edge of the parking lot, and every time I drove past those flowers that fall, I would sob and wail in my car. I was crying in public, too. Crying as I wrote in my journal at Dunkin' Donuts, crying as I put the heavy napkins and silverware on the tables at the fancy restaurant, crying as I biked home across the river at midnight. But I marveled, too. I marveled at the feeling of being heartbroken. I had loved and lost plenty of times, most of the time, really, because I seemed to fall for men who couldn't love me back. But I had never let myself feel it. I numbed up, moved on. But this time, perhaps because it had happened so fast, I didn't numb up. And I found this feeling, even through my tears, interesting. I ran on the paths along the Charles River, and I thought, this is what happens to people. This is what people and books and movies are talking about when they talk about losing love. People's hearts break, and it feels like this. It feels like someone has beaten you up with brass knuckles. But it also felt, at the same time, like the universe was welcoming me in. I was heartbroken, but I felt less alone than I had in a long while. In November, I met a man I liked. He asked me out, then canceled on the morning of our first date, saying on my sister's machine that he had to leave town unexpectedly. He wrote me a letter saying he would be back before New Year's. The letter was postmarked New Mexico. He said I could write him there at his aunt's, but I didn't. I wrote him off. Another man who isn't ready, I thought. Not even for a first date. The poet came back on a cold night. We walked my sister's dog. He played me a video of his father, who was mentally ill, that he had recorded that day. I watched and felt terrible for him. He sat on my sister's couch, and I saw the full breadth of his pain. When I walked him to his truck that night, there was a defeated, restless charge between us, and I punched him in the stomach, lightly, but he looked alarmed by something he saw in me. Perhaps everything I wanted that he couldn't give. After he drove away, it began to snow, and I was glad the first snow of the year had held off until he was gone. A week later, the man in New Mexico came back east. We had our first date and many more, and I married him. My heart was ready for him, for his kindness and honesty, his easy, steady love for me, for that kind of love, the mutual kind. My heart was open because I had finally let it break.
Zoe Lister-Jones, reading Lily King's essay, An Empty Heart is One That Can Be Filled. We'll hear the latest from Lily after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Lily King is no stranger to having her work published. She's an accomplished novelist whose most recent book, Euphoria, won the 2014 Kirkus Prize and the New England Book Award for Fiction. But having her Modern Love essay published was another story.
It was very hard to think about publishing when it actually was accepted. I mean, I think writers, at least I do this thing where I write it and I send it out and I don't think about the consequences until somebody says, we'll take that. And then I'm like, oh no, what have I done? It did feel exposing. Even people who knew me at the time and knew me when I was going through this, they were sort of surprised by some of the details.
But while having the essay published was tricky, Lily says writing it was not.
This is a story that had been kind of rolling around in my head for, you know, probably 18 years or something. One day I just started it and it just came right out of me, kind of all in one big rush. And by that time I'd been married, you know, maybe 15 years, and I had two kids, and I could kind of put all of the pieces together in a way that I couldn't when it had first happened to me. And I might have had the impulse to write about it then, but I didn't have the perspective.
Lily didn't tell the poet about the modern love piece before it was published, but she knew he'd read it when he sent her an email a year or two later.
And he was very, very kind about it. And he sort of explained his side of things with a lot more detail than I had known during that time.
Lily's also thought more deeply about the root of a pattern she mentioned in the essay, her tendency to pursue men who were emotionally unavailable.
My father was a pretty committed alcoholic all my life. And I think that that is a very common way for people to push other people away. You know, I know it's a terrible cliche, but I think for a while I chose men who kept me at that kind of a distance because it was so familiar. It takes a long time to break that pattern.
But she broke it for good with her husband, Tyler. They've been married almost 19 years now, and they live in Yarmouth, Maine, with their two teenage daughters. So what did Tyler think of Lily unearthing the details of a previous relationship?
I asked him if he had any trouble with me publishing it, and he said he didn't care at all. And I believed him, and it proved to be true. I don't think he's ever given it another thought until today when he dropped me off to come talk about it. We both put our relationship and our family above everything else, and that has been a big surprise to me. I married the right guy, which is a small miracle, I think.
Lily King. She's the author of several novels, including Euphoria, and she's currently working on another. Daniel Jones weighs in on writing about heartbreak in a minute.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
As the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times, Daniel Jones knows everything there is to know about heartbreak, or so he thought, until he read Lily King's essay.
It never really occurred to me that you should have your heart deeply broken in order to have it refilled. But, you know, there's a certain logic to it, and it was really the first time I read an essay that articulated being open to love in that way. You know, it's such a perfect moment when she thinks, oh, this is what a broken heart is, as if she's looking at herself from outside of herself and thinking like, oh, I'm experiencing this thing that everyone's always talking about, getting your heart broken. Like, that's a gift of an authentic experience or something that, okay, now I get this, and then maybe once I get this, I'll be open to what real love is because I've gone through real heartbreak.
Zoe Lister-Jones was also drawn to Lily's depiction of heartbreak, and she told us it's an all-too-familiar feeling.
Especially as an adolescent, it was a feeling that I lived in almost constantly. Whether it's in romantic relationships or friendships or within family structures, the heart breaks so often. And so I just thought that the way that that feeling was articulated in this piece was so specific and beautiful and resonant for me.
Thank you to Zoe for reading this week's essay. You can see her in the movie Band-Aid, which she wrote, directed, and stars in. It's in theaters now. You can also see Zoe in season 3 of Life in Pieces on CBS. It comes out this fall. Next week on Modern Love, Cynthia Adai Robinson, star of the USA series Shooter, reads a story about single motherhood by choice.
I hate having to be the sole emotional and financial provider for my child. The pressure's too great. If you slip, there's no one to catch you. But worse, there's no one to catch your baby. So somewhere among potty training, play dates, bylines, and balancing the household books, I lost pieces of myself I'm only now trying to reclaim.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. Additional sound design this week by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.